Hi, Nancy.
Welcome to episode 58 of the Front Porch Book Club.
The Front Porch Book Club is a podcast that meets twice a month.
We like to dig deep into the relationship between characters and the worlds they live in.
Grab your book and iced tea and join us on the front porch.
Today, we interview Joe Starita about his book, I Am a Man. This book describes the real-life story of Ponca Chief Standing Bear. He was a man who just wanted to live peaceably with his tribe on their ancestral homeland that was deeded to them by the U.S. government in a treaty. However, government mistakes, prejudice, and people just following orders from their superiors led to the Ponca being stripped of their homeland in 1877, many deaths on their journey to the reservation in Oklahoma, and eventually Chief Standing Bear's suit against the federal government, the first time a Native American had been allowed to testify in a U.S. courtroom. And he won.
Which is great news. It's really a remarkable story, Nancy, but it is heartbreaking. Joe Starita, author of I Am a Man, beautifully portrays how important their Nebraska homeland was to the Ponca and how poorly they were treated. He also helps us understand the legal and bureaucratic issues and the importance of Chief Standing Bear's lawsuit and its ramifications. Joe Starita, our guest today, is a professor in the College of Journalism and Mass Communications at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Before joining the journalism faculty, Starita spent 13 years at the Miami Herald and served as the paper's New York bureau chief, and was also on the investigations team where he was named a Pulitzer Prize finalist in local recording. He is also the author of The Dull Knives of Pine Ridge, a Lakota Odyssey, about five generations of a Native American family. That book has been translated into six languages and was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. I Am a Man was published by St. Martin's Press in 2009. His most recent book is A Warrior of the People, which tells the story of Susan LaFleche, the first Native American medical doctor. Starita has received many awards for his work, including the Chief Standing Bear Humanitarian Award from the Nebraska Commission on Indian Affairs, and a National Civil Rights Award from the National Education Association. And we are so delighted to have him join us today on our front porch.
We sure are. Let's get to it. Welcome to the front porch, Joe.
I'm happy to be on the front porch, and I hope I can get through the front door as well.
Sugar in our iced tea, so I think you're going to be fine.
Okay, sounds good.
Well, we're so excited to have you join us today. We loved your book, Learning About Chief Standing Bear, and how he forced the U.S. government to examine its treatment of Native Americans. Your previous book, The Dull Knives of Pine Ridge, also focused on Great Plains Native Americans. Can you tell us how you became interested in the history of Native Americans?
Yes, I can. And before that, I would just like to say for the record that we are talking and conducting this conversation today on the 147th anniversary of the Little Bighorn.
Wow.
147 okay. years ago today, under the command of the great Lakota war chief Crazy Horse, he and his warriors wiped out Custer's regiment to the very last man and sent them off to the spirit world. And so here we are also using that seminal moment in American Western history to talk about another Great Plains chief who created a very valuable chapter in American history in a much different way than Crazy Horse and George Custer.
Yeah.
I got interested in Native Americans from a very early age. The Native footprint in Nebraska is very large. And in fact, if you look at the names of all the states west of the Mississippi River, you will find an inordinate number of the names of our states derived from Native words. Nebraska is an Oto Indian word that literally in Oto means flat water. And that word refers to the Platte River. Minnesota, for example, is a Lakota word. Many is water and Sota is land. So waterland. Oklahoma is a Choctaw Native American word that literally means red people. So you just go on and on and on, and many, many, many of the states west of the Mississippi are named after a Native American word, and Nebraska is where I grew up. The Native footprint is very large, and you don't really know what gets things clicking. Why did that click instead of building soapbox derbies or collecting baseball cards or whatever? You get exposed to a lot of things. And we went on a family outing when I was about 8 or 9 years old to Fort Robinson. Ooh. In northwest corner of Nebraska. Beautiful, beautiful spot where Crazy Horse was imprisoned and killed. He was bayoneted in the back by an army private. And rather than bleed to death on an army cot where they put him in a jailhouse cell, he rolled off the cot and landed on the ground because he wanted to die on Mother Earth and not on an army cot. So it was stories like that that got me really hooked on finding out more about who these Native people were. And, you know, it starts off when you're 8 or 9 or 10 in a kind of simplistic fashion. I always was very angry for a long time at my parents that we weren't Native American.
Yeah.
Because through my 8, 9, 10-year-old eyes, you got to live in a teepee.
Mm-hmm.
You got to go out and hunt and fish and run around in the woods and splash in the river and build a fire that nobody would arrest you, ride a horse. Come on. What could be better than that? Well, gradually I got a little bit more sophisticated than that. And I became really then and now intensely interested in the differences between Native culture and the dominant culture that eventually subsumed their hold on the land and many of their cultural practices. I think I can generalize. There are 574 federally recognized tribes in the United States of America. And I think without exception, I could generalize and say the core value of those 574 tribes for thousands and thousands of years, and for many of them, most of them, up to this 147th anniversary of the Little Bighorn, they are a we-based culture. It's about we, and their language reflects that concept that everybody's got everybody else's back. The Navajo, which we call Navajo, they refer to themselves as the Diné. And the Diné in their language means the people. The people. I mean, what is more illuminative of how a culture views itself than referring to the entire Navajo nation as the people? And you find that that's the only way they could survive on these Great Plains with terrific winters, harsh, harsh climates, scalding summers, inches and feet of snow and sub-zero weather. If you went out in a Great Plains village, and you got three elk and a deer. You didn't come back home and put all of that meat in your teepee. You shared it with the elders who did not have a son who was of age to go out and hunt. Crazy Horse was universally beloved among all of the Lakota for his generosity, for his we concept. And that is a very distinct difference between the two cultures. We are much more a me-based culture, and that's reflected in our language. Language creates culture, and culture creates language.
That definitely came across in your book, Joe, that there was a sense of community there with the Ponca, and they moved as a tribe. They supported each other in that way.
Yes.
And I've heard that before about Native American culture, that it's very much we focused.
Yes.
I'm interested in your perspective of when the tribe moves out of their area and Chief Standing Bear isolates himself from his tribe. They're down there by the creek and they've been dumped off. And he kind of removes himself from them and he goes out into the woods and then he leaves from there. And because he's kind of isolated himself, the people didn't know that he actually left to go back home to Nebraska.
No, certainly not all of them. You know, he had a lot going on personally. I mean, he was one of the chiefs. He wasn't the chief.
Right.
He was one of the chiefs. And he had already suffered enormous losses just from a family standpoint. You know, you have to figure that first year between the summer of 1877 and the summer of 1878, one third of the Ponca tribe died.
Yeah.
Right.
One third, one out of every three Ponca the first year they were there died. And another thing worth noting in the difference between Native culture and our culture is it just a sentence I'll quote from one of my favorite writers, the brilliant Kentucky poet and essayist, Wendell Berry. Wendell Berry once wrote, "If you don't know where you are, you don't know who you are." And just think of the enormous power of that simple sentence. If you don't know where you are, you don't know who you are. The degree to which place informs who you are and shapes your identity. Turn that back on yourself. Do you think where you grew up was instrumental in forming your identity? What state, what country, what part of the state, what city, what part of the city? What family you were raised in? What school you went to? What teachers you had? What friends you had? What synagogue, church, mosque you worshiped at? And here you have a group of people who had lived in the northeast corner of Nebraska for 200 years. Beautiful, beautiful part of the country, with the Niobrara River being the heart of this land. They knew every rock. They knew every tree. They knew the best fishing holes. And most importantly, it was where their seven sacred burial sites were.
Right.
When Crazy Horse again was asked, "Where are your lands?" his response was, "My lands are where my fathers lie buried." Mm. So the pull of place in defining who you were had an enormous impact on Standing Bear. And he began to think of how to get back to this place that defined who he was. Maybe more so than the others who were too beaten down, who were too crippled by disease, who were too annihilated by loss of so many family members. And the final straw for Standing Bear, who more and more was thinking about how desperately he missed his homeland, was Christmas week of 1878. What happens? He's off in his own little cluster of 30 people, his family and followers, and curled up in a fetal position on the bottom of this dank army canvas tent is his only son, a 16-year-old boy by the name of Bearshield, who lay dying of tuberculosis. But before his eyes closed in death, he begged his father, the chief, to take his body back to their beloved homeland. And that love between a father and a son, that father who had spent 16 years grooming Bear Shield to take over the tribe, to start learning the white ways and be the bridge from the old world to the new world. And now that 16-year-old boy whom Standing Bear had invested all of the historical and cultural knowledge of the Ponca and encouraged him to learn as much of the white way of life as possible, including English. Now he was dying. And before his eyes closed in death, he made Standing Bear promise. And so Standing Bear, I don't think, was the least bit conflicted about, he had already been pointing his star north, and once his only son basically evoked a promise from his father, the chief, it was a done deal. He was out of there.
Yeah. In the book, you make the case that the Ponca were viewed as maybe being even more attached to their land than other tribes, that they just had this affinity for their homelands, even to a greater extent than others.
Yes, absolutely true. And again, that's why I love that quote so much from Wendell Berry, because it is so on point with what you just said in defining the Ponca did not know who they were anymore in Oklahoma. Their identity had been taken from them. They didn't know the rocks in Oklahoma. They saw trees they'd never seen before. They saw plants they'd never seen before. They saw animals they'd never seen before. They saw a heat and humidity that they'd never found before. This was not home. This was about as far from home as you could get if you were a Ponca in the late decade of the 1870s. Mm-hmm. It's not just a physical thing, it's a spiritual thing. And that was as haunting as anything else. It's almost impossible to overstate the spiritual relationship between the Ponca and where they buried their dead. Mm-hmm. It's a powerful, powerful pull, and it's just something that many could not take any longer.
Yeah.
And Standing Bear was certainly one of those.
Yeah. In your book, I Am a Man, you delve into so many aspects of the story of Chief Standing Bear: cultural, historical, legal, agricultural, religious, and you even sprinkle in some interviews with modern day Ponca tribe members. How did you go about researching all these interconnected aspects of the story of Chief Standing Bear?
If you are a writer and you are writing a biography, the best tool on your tool belt is to have a completely obsessive personality. That is the best tool you have. And okay. I am completely an obsessive person. Once I lock down on something, that's it. You would have to use some heavy equipment to pry my jaws open.
As you're answering this, tell us how you locked on to Chief Standing Bear, and then tell us more about what you did once you locked on to Chief Standing Bear.
Well, once I sat down with a Ponca friend at a three-hour lunch, and walking out at 3 o'clock that afternoon, having heard for the first time the narrative arc of this story, that was it.
Okay.
I knew, walking out of that Mexican restaurant, having heard the three-hour distillation of this story, and I that's what I do. I mean, some people collect stamps, some people collect dolls, some people collect hot rods. I collect stories. I collect good stories. And I walked out of that three-hour session hearing the story of Standing Bear for the first time in its beginning, middle, and end phase, and the needle just went in. And it was an obsession right from the beginning. So I instantly began, in the days and weeks that followed, to rearrange the furniture in my room, figuratively, so I could create the space that I would need to indulge my obsession. to give you an example of how obsessed I was with this story, the pivotal chapter, the whole book hangs on chapter 6, The Color of Blood, the courtroom scene.
Yes.
That's the seminal chapter. If you screw up that chapter, it doesn't matter how good the first 5 chapters are or the last 5 chapters. If you screw up The Color of Blood, that hands are not the color of yours, but if you pierce it, you will feel pain. That magnificent speech. I was so obsessed with making sure I got that right that I moved from Lincoln, Nebraska, where I had written the first 5 chapters, to Sorrento, Italy. I rented a room in this hotel on the Italian Mediterranean coast where nobody could get a hold of me unless I wanted them to. And there were only 2 people that I gave my email access to. And I lived on the top floor of this hotel for a month. And I had the same ritualistic practice every day. I would get up at 7 o'clock. I would open up the shutters. Mount Vesuvius was framed outside my window. The Bay of Naples was at my feet. And then I would have to close all those shutters and open up the computer. And it was just an 8-hour focus every day just on that chapter, with no contact with any distractions. I had relatives, Italian relatives, who lived a 10-minute train ride away. I would spend Sundays with them just to rejoin the human race. But your question was, and my answer is, that obsession is what you need to really do this story justice. And another thing that people don't understand that also is an obsession, and I would try and teach this, is the relationship between good writing and good music. If you take good writing and superimpose it over good music, it's a tight, snug fit. Good music is about beat, rhythm, cadence, syncopation. Good writing is about beat, rhythm, syncopation, cadence. It's the same. And I would be laying in bed some nights at 3 o'clock in the morning, replaying a sentence or a paragraph that I'd written in Standing Bear's biography 12 hours earlier. And I wanted that sentence to sound like Luciano Pavarotti. And the more I ground my teeth and laid in bed, the more it sounded like Roseanne Barr singing the Star Spangled Banner. I defy anybody to try and sleep through that. And I didn't. I would get up, I would pad down the steps, and I would put on some coffee, and sometimes it would be 6 below and a foot of snow, and I could never allow myself to have any self-pity, even though it was cold and dark and snowy. I was thinking, are you kidding me? Shut up. This man walked in the dead of winter.
Oh my, the walk.
550 miles with no winter clothing, no money, and no food, and yeah. You're whining about whether or not you should turn the temperature up from 76 to 78. Just shut up and get to work.
Yeah.
It seems like you must have relied on a lot of primary data sources.
Yes.
Where did you go to do this research, and how important were the interviews that you did with the modern day Panca?
Yeah. This whole, the whole umbrella topic is called narrative nonfiction. Mm-hmm. What I'm trying to do here, and what I did with the Dull Knives, and what I did with the last book, A Warrior of the People, it's a technique of writing called narrative nonfiction, which is taking the tools of the traditional tools of the fiction writer, of the Mark Twains, of the Ernest Hemingways, of the Norman Mailers, of the John Steinbecks, taking their bag of tools, flashbacks, foreshadowing, strong protagonists, snatches of dialogue. You take all of their tools and you roll it over and apply it to a nonfiction setting. And the only way you can do that is if you drill down so deep that you have got all of this information. What I've often said is, when you're starting the research and you're going to write it in a narrative nonfiction way, you have a brand new Hoover vacuum cleaner, you kick it on high, and you run it over every potential landscape repository of letters, treaties, documents, anything that has Standing Bear's name on it, you want in that bag. So when you turn it off a year later, a year and a half later, I spent a year and a half just on research, having that Hoover bag running across the Nebraska State Historical Society archives, Oklahoma State Historical Society archives, South Dakota State Historical National Archives in Washington, D.C., New York Public Library, and then finding who were the direct descendants and who were the Ponca elders who could tell me not the story in a official treaty government document, but the oral history of the tribe. So you've got to take all of those strands of DNA, the strand of DNA you found at the Nebraska State Historical Society that told me what the treaties were between Standing Bear and the government. You've got to take that strand of DNA that had the diary of the agent, the diary of the agent that he kept on the track. You talk about a six-year-old boy seeing his first shiny swim bicycle. That was me when I came across John Burke's diary.
Yeah.
That's a primary source document that is worth its weight in gold if you are the obsessive Captain Ahab writing Moby Dick.
Right.
So for me, it was just pounding. If there is a single piece of paper anywhere in the world with Standing Bear's name on it, not only would I be surprised, I would be absolutely ashamed and humiliated. So that's the kind of obsessive mindset you've got to have, is going after every single piece of paper, treaties, documents, diaries, transcripts, newspaper articles. And then you have to open up that bag, dump it all on the table, and try not to faint. And then you have to start thinking, how am I going to take 18 months of research and take this mountain that you've spent a year and a half accumulating, and how are you going to sculpt that mountain into a page turner? What are you going to keep in? What are you going to leave out? You can't use it all. That's not a page turner. You've got to take just the parts that really matter and use them in the most effective narrative nonfiction way possible, so that the reader, after three or four pages, is not tempted to get up and walk Fido or go to the golf course and work on a short game. You want his butt riveted in that Barco lounger thinking, oh my God, I can't believe what I'm reading. How could the mother of White Buffalo Girl?
Oh, yes. Oh, no.
How could she
survive? We cried over that last time.
Right.
Oh.
I want to pull the reader inside the tent of the mother of White Buffalo Girl, who in the course of 72 hours, 3 days, had lost her land, had lost her home, had lost almost all of her belongings, and then had lost her only daughter.
Yeah.
You got to get the reader inside her head, inside that tent, inside her heart.
Yeah.
You need the research to do that. This is nonfiction. You're not making any of this up. And that just takes hard hour after hour, day after day, week after week, digging until you get the DNA that forms the body of this story.
Yeah. Well, you certainly did. And I thank you for your diligence from a historical standpoint and putting all of that into a very readable document. And yes, I was in that tent with that mother going, how in the world can she go on?
Yes.
But the whole story was very much a heavy trip like that for me.
Yes.
Through every aching 600-mile step these poor people made. And then the 600 miles back. It's just quite a riveting story, but I appreciated all through it the information that you got and that you were being factual with it as you went through the story. So thank you very much for that.
Yeah. I mean, you can't make this story up. Why would you want to try and take chances and fictionalize it? How could you make up a story that is more amazing and credible than the factual basis that formed the narrative arc of this story? My job as the writer is to get out of the way of the story. Get out of the way. Let the story come directly to the reader without the reader ever feeling like they've got your hand on the back of their neck, pushing their face down into the page, forcing them to feel something that they didn't feel or didn't want to feel. The second you do that, that's a felony. You should go to literary prison or literary hell, depending on how bad it is. And a story like this, no. Your primary obligation is to get out of the way of the story. So the story flows directly from you to inside that tent with the mother of White Buffalo Girl. Inside that tent was Standing Bear in the final hours of his son's life. Your job is to get out of the way and just let the story come to the reader and get them inside those places where the story lives.
Well, you did that beautifully. You mentioned The Color of Blood, that pivotal chapter in the book, and really the significance of this suit that Chief Standing Bear filed against the U.S. government is remarkable. Yeah. The fact that he was even granted a hearing was remarkable, but the decision also recognized for the first time that in American history, an Indian is a person. Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about why Chief Standing Bear's appearance in that Omaha courtroom was so important?
Well, it was important for a number of reasons. First of all, and this is something that you have to do when you're writing this story, is you have to provide the context. We're talking the spring of 1879. We're talking 3 years after the Little Bighorn, not 147 years, 3 years after the Little Bighorn. This was not a part of the country that was welcoming Native Americans with open arms. There was a great deal of hostility, a great deal of anger, a great deal of hatred. They were seen as impediments on the road to civilization. The occupiers of land that was just laying fallow and not being used for any purpose. There was a great deal of hatred of Native Americans as worthless, as roadblocks to progress, and all of that. Roadblocks that had to be just destroyed. And into that historical context, into just 3 years after the Little Bighorn, we have this sympathetic figure who ends up in a courtroom on the corner of 15th and Dodge Streets in Omaha, Nebraska. And what you have to realize and pull back and look at is all of the stars lined up just perfectly. This could not have been replicated. And one of the critical parts of this story, the most critical star that lined up, was Brigadier General George Crook, who in many ways is the hero of this story.
So true.
Because if it wasn't for Brigadier General George Crook, the highest ranking military man west of the Mississippi, a West Point graduate, a decorated Civil War veteran, a man who had spent 30 years fighting Native Americans, it was he who decided to saddle up his horse under the cover of darkness after midnight and ride 3 miles south to a newspaper editor's office, of all places, and knock on the door and give this story to Thomas Henry Tibbles. Had George Crook not been, had he not done that, we don't have this conversation. That set in motion the whole story, but everything was ready to go. It just needed somebody to light the torch. And that somebody was General George Crook, who ironically became the defendant in the case. I mean, the irony is just it's overwhelming. Look, when he saw this bedraggled group struggling across the lower parade ground in late March of 1879, he was absolutely shocked at the near-death look of particularly the women, who had bags of charred flesh hanging off their elbows that looked like charred bacon. They were so severely frostbitten. And he knew, as a military man through and through, that he had gotten a direct order earlier that day from his superior, Lieutenant General Philip Sheridan, in Chicago, who had famously said a few years earlier, "The only good Indian is a dead Indian." He was told by his superior not to give them mercy, not to let them stay and rest up and get better. His orders were turn their faces south and move them right back from where they came, so that all the people that we have put into Oklahoma don't get the idea, if you just want to leave your reservation, all you have to do is go the Standing Bear way, just walk off it. So Crook, I can imagine, walking, pacing back and forth in his office, in his bedroom, late into the night, his civilian conscience at war with his military conscience. Am I going to be a military man and follow my orders, or am I going to be a human being and try and help these people? And I think it was probably 51-49 where the needle pushed ever so slightly towards the humanitarian side that allowed him to saddle up the horse under the cover of darkness. And once it gets to the reporter, then it gets in the paper, then the two most prominent lawyers in Omaha read it in the paper, and Andrew Jackson Poppleton, you can't make these names up, the most prominent lawyer in Nebraska, the first lawyer admitted to the bar in the state of Nebraska, the former mayor of Omaha, the current general counsel for the Union Pacific Railroad. He picks up a story written by the reporter that General Crook had leaked it to and says, "I want a piece of this. I want a piece of this. I want to make a new law." And he got John Webster, an up-and-coming superstar, as his assistant. And all of these stars just lined up. And he got a judge who previously, you could say, was an Indian-hating judge, if you looked at his rulings. He had never ruled anything that you can consider favorable. He was a grizzled, grizzly bear hunting frontier judge who was so struck by the humanity of a father losing his son, but promising that no matter what, he would repatriate his remains in their sacred homeland. Who does that? Who walks 550 miles in the dead of winter into the teeth of a Canadian blizzard, 19 below zero on the day that you left, and rummaged for field corn and boiling it over an open fire, sticking the women and children inside haystacks to keep them from freezing to death, day after day, week after week, month after month? And when the judge heard the full story, there was just something that struck him in a way that no other story had. And he very meticulously spent 12 days going over this. And in the end, after he had reviewed all of the evidence, it came down to a simple question. The government was arguing he had no right to grant the writ of habeas corpus. In English, a legal mechanism that says, bring me the body. In even more conventional English, a writ of habeas corpus forces the government to prove that they have the legal right, in this case, to jail Standing Bear and his people. What legal right did they have? And as Judge Dundee diligently noted, and as Andrew Jackson Poppleton pointed out, it says that any person can file a writ of habeas corpus. The government lawyers were saying, no, he's an Indian. He's not a person. He's a ward of the government who has no legal status in an American courtroom. Well, the whole case came down to that one word. Any person has the right to file a writ of habeas corpus. Was Standing Bear a person? And if he was a person, then he had the legal right to force the government to explain on what grounds were they jailing him and his 29 followers. And if you read that 12-page opinion that Judge Dundee released on May 12th, 1879, it's remarkable in many ways, but it all comes down to the fact that this man, not a person, who could make that claim? He is, in Judge Dundee's historic, groundbreaking ruling, he is a person entitled to the same constitutional privileges as the more fortunate white race. And that was historic. 22 years earlier, Dred Scott, a slave, a freedman, a former slave, had walked into a federal courtroom in St. Louis and asked the federal court to do exactly the same thing that the federal court judge in Omaha had done with Standing Bear. Declare me a free man. Declare me a person. And that case went all the way to the United States Supreme Court, where the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in 1857 famously said in his majority opinion that a Negro has no rights a white man is bound to respect. So that was the end of the line for Dred Scott and a black man seeking his freedom from the federal courts. But 22 years later, a native man asked the court to do the same thing. And it's historic on so many different levels. And it remains a remarkable judgment. And it set in motion the wheels of justice, we know, grind slowly, and Judge Dundee's decision declaring Standing Bear a person within the meaning of the law for the first time in the history, 3 years after the Little Bighorn, that set in motion what would, we've heard the wheels of justice grind slowly. They do, but they ground on until 1924 when the lead domino that had fallen in Standing Bear's favor in 1879 resulted in Native Americans becoming citizens of the United States with the right to vote. And that all was set up by what happened in Judge Dundee's courtroom on the corner of 15th and Dodge Streets in Omaha, Nebraska, 3 years after the Little Bighorn.
Chief Standing Bear, I knew nothing about him before I read your book. One of the things I wanted to talk to you about is the assimilation that it seems like he was taking towards the European way. At one point in the book, he wants to cut his hair. People talk him against it, but then he does cut his hair. And at first I was taken back like, what? Your beautiful black straight hair. Why would you cut that? That's who you are. That's your people. That, you know, that's your culture. But he cuts it. What? Can you tell us what you, did you read anything about what his decision was to cut the hair?
Well, here's the bigger picture on that question. Imagine being the chief of any of the 500 plus tribes in the last quarter of the 19th century. Imagine the pressure on you. Your primary responsibility as a chief is the welfare of your people. Nothing supersedes that. You as the chief have to make decisions that ensure the survival of your people. And imagine 1879, 1880, 1881, 1872, imagine any of those years in the 70s and 80s and 90s that you were the principal chief of your tribe. What decisions would you make in order to ensure the survival of your people? It's clear that you cannot win militarily. And if you try and go that route, which Crazy Horse did, your entire tribe is going to be wiped out. You're going to be annihilated. So Standing Bear like almost every other chief in the last quarter of the 19th century, came to a fork in the road. We can turn left and remain traditionalists and risk total annihilation, or we can turn right and try and find a way to compromise by introducing white values, but merging them with traditional Native values. That is a route that a number of prominent chiefs took because they saw that as the only way to survive. That's why Standing Bear sent Bear Shield, his 16-year-old son, to school. He wanted him to learn English. He wanted him to learn American history. He wanted him to be able to have all of the cultural values of the Ponca, but also marry them to the language and the history that was the future and was the best guarantee that Bear Shield would be able to survive and have a family. And so it's just a reflection, the haircutting, it's just a reflection of the pressure that these chiefs were under to try and thread the needle between retaining the old ways and the old values, but walking this cultural tightrope where they could also include the new way of life. And it's the reality of it. There was no getting away from it. There was no place to go. There was no military solution. So these chiefs were really in a very, very complex trap almost, where they had to figure out a way of maintaining their cultural identity and also being able to have the tools to pass on to their children so their children would be able to function in the New World Order. And that included English. That included knowing about the Bible. That included knowing about European history. And these chiefs thought, if we can give our children those tools, then they've got a chance. They've got a chance. Without those, they have no chance.
It seemed in some ways to me, not being a historian, so I'm interested in hearing your thought on this, were the Ponca more assimilated than some of the other tribes at that point? They had their own school. They had a Christian church. They had their own mill. They had white houses. I don't remember how you wrote it. Were they more assimilated than some of the other tribes? And did that help, do you think, their cause at the end?
The answer is yes. The Ponca, in many ways, by far, were far more assimilated than the vast majority of the tribes. It had become a point of pride, a badge of honor, if you will, among the Ponca, that no Ponca had ever harmed a white person. And the Lakota hated them for that philosophy. The Lakota called them women. The Lakota would do raids on their cornfields and pull up all of their corn and kill some of their men and kill some of their women because they were so disgusted that the Ponca were appearing to kowtow to the white wave of settlers washing across the Great Plains. But the Ponca, by and large, saw they were farmers more than they were warriors. I mean, they transformed the Niobrara River Valley into this lush field of pumpkins and squash and corn. If it weren't for the agricultural skills of the Ponca, there were many white people who would have died coming across the Mississippi not knowing what Nebraska winters were like. They would starve to death. But the Ponca fed them, and they taught them the agricultural practices. That's not anything that the Lakota, for example, would have ever done. But the Ponca did, and they saw that as a way to survive. And so they were among the very first tribes in the Western United States to, in some ways, adopt what we would call white ways, whether it's farming, whether it's living in individual houses instead of teepees or huts. They were progressive, may not be the right word, but it's probably close to the right word, mm-hmm. among the tribes in that very complicated, very violent last quarter of the 19th century, where you have both bookended by the Little Bighorn on one end and the massacre at Wounded Knee on the other. In between, there's just a lot of churning and reconfiguring answers to the one basic question: what do we need to do to survive? And that's what was on every chief, and different chiefs had different answers for that.
Yeah.
Standing Bear's answer for the Ponca, Joseph LaFleche's answer for the Omaha was, hey, the writing's on the wall. If we don't adapt and adopt some of these ways, we will be banished from the face of the earth.
Yeah. One of the exciting things about the story of Standing Bear is that it seems he is getting a lot more recognition. In 2019, the state of Nebraska placed a 9-foot-tall statue of Chief Standing Bear, his hand outstretched, in Statuary Hall in the U.S. Capitol. This year, the U.S. Postal Service honored Chief Standing Bear with a forever stamp of his likeness, and the newest high school in Lincoln, Nebraska is being named for Chief Standing Bear. Why do you think it's taken so long for his story to be known? And what is it about his story that you think is resonating now?
Well, I think it took so long. I'll go back to your colleague's comment, is that you had never heard of Standing Bear.
Right.
Knew nothing about Standing Bear. Why is that? Well,
okay, I was never very good at history, so that may be one of the...
No, I'm using you as the majority.
I would think so, yes.
Well, yeah. Most people have never heard of Standing Bear, and they've never heard of this story. Why? Who knows? It's just a story that was there, but it just kind of hung as low-hanging fruit for a long time until it got plucked. But it did get plucked, and the reason that this is such a powerful story is, if you were to make a list of every value, everything that we value, personal characteristics as Americans, honesty, courage, perseverance, love of family, love of homeland, make as long a list as you want. Standing Bear checks every box. He checks every box.
Yeah.
It is not just a Native American. This is an extraordinary human being who did things that none of us would have done out of love for his son and love for his people. None of us would have walked 550 miles in the dead of winter with no winter clothing, food, or money. But he did.
Yeah.
And once that story gets out, it's just impossible not to kind of embrace it. I just think when you're exposed to the reality of it, you just see it play out time after time after time. People hear this story and their first question is, why haven't I heard this story before? Why didn't I read about this man in my history book? And I was a history major, but I never knew this story. Well, that's changing. That's changing now. And that's not unusual. I mean, it's not unusual that something goes ignored or whatever for a long time, and then it catches fire, particularly now with so many media outlets. You can find this in so many different ways. And in Standing Bear's case, yes, there was, on May 12th of this year, the United States Postal Service had a big ceremony on the Mall in Lincoln, Nebraska, down from the Capitol, where there is a similar statue, and the U.S. Postal Service commemorated Standing Bear on the day that Judge Dundee released the opinion that was seminal to Native American legal rights, and they issued the first Standing Bear stamp. So his profile has continued to rise over the course of the last 10 years, and it keeps rising. There is a movie that's based on the book that's in the works that has a great deal of potential, I think. It's titled I Am a Man, and one of the co-directors and co-writers of the story is a Irish producer and director by the name of Jim Sheridan, who's been nominated for 16 Academy Awards. And he won one for a movie called My Left Foot.
Oh, right.
With Daniel Day-Lewis in it, who won the Academy Award. And Jim Sheridan loves this story. He loves this story. And he's got a lot of powerful people backing him. And there is some talk that he and his good friend Daniel Day-Lewis, he may get Daniel Day-Lewis to play Brigadier General George Crook in the movie.
Oh, that'd be great.
Oh, I love it.
You would actually, I think, do a good job in that part.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, congratulations for that. I hope that it does make a movie.
Yes. And this is what's important to get back to your original question is it's like a lot of things. You start tugging on the ball of yarn and you keep tugging and it's amazing what eventually happens. And that's what's happened here. It was a ball of yarn with a little tiny clip on it and somebody grabbed it and tugged on it and then it just started to unravel. And that's what's happening. And what is so good above everything else we've said, the takeaway from the elevation of Standing Bear's profile is what it means to not only Ponca people, but what it means to Native people. That those Native kids sitting in a fifth grade class in Denver, those eighth grade kids sitting in a class in Atlanta, those seniors in high school sitting in a history class in Seattle, they're going to know about this man. They're not going to be like us who went through high school, went through college without ever having heard this name in their lives. And it's going to have a tremendous, I think, tremendously important impact on Native people because you can't be what you can't see. And if you can see that statue, if you can see that stamp, if you can see that book, if you can see that movie, all of that, those tributaries flow into one river that makes you proud of who you are, inspires you to want to do something heroic and something important in a way that the absence of which does not. So for all of those reasons, I'm very, very, very excited and happy to have watched the star of Standing Bear ascend higher and higher into the American historical skylight. And I hope that it just keeps ascending because he deserves it. And we deserve to know about these kinds of people. And Native Americans need to have another hero that they call one of their own.
Joe, you started the Chief Standing Bear Journey for Justice Scholarship Fund in 2012, and annually it awards scholarships to Nebraska Native American high school graduates. This past year, 9 students were awarded $2,000 scholarships. What motivated you to create the scholarship, and what other ways are you involved with Native people today?
What motivated me to create the scholarship was just very simple and cut from some of the cloth that we just talked about. I wanted to find a vehicle to make college or a vocational college realistic to what are often the poorest people in Nebraska. Nebraska is a state comprised of 93 counties, the poorest. Statistically, the poorest of those 93 counties is Thurston County, not coincidentally the home of the Omaha tribe, split between the village of Walt Hill and Macy. I think you could argue Macy is the single poorest community in the entire state of Nebraska. And it also, not coincidentally, Thurston County has the highest suicide rate in Nebraska.
Oh my goodness.
Of course you want to try and help them. Of course, you want to do what you can to give them a chance. In February of 2021, there were more than 20 suicide attempts on the Omaha reservation in one night, about 7 of them successful.
Oh my goodness.
And when you hear something like that, it certainly inspires you to try to do something about it. And at any rate, I've been involved, as we've talked about earlier, with Native culture since I was like 7-8 years old. And the older you get, you know, supposedly, and I think most times you have more wisdom and you can see things a little bit clearer. But this was a no-brainer. This was a no-brainer. I want to do something to help those high school kids in Walled Hill, those high school kids in Macy, those high school kids in Winnebago, in Shadron, in Scotts Bluff, wherever. If you're a native student and you fill out this application, me and my committee, which is largely other Native Americans, we will do everything we can to try and get you an opportunity to get an education that leads to a job that will support a family, that will make you a stakeholder in your community and not find you at the end of a rope. So it's a way to try and build hope. And it's been quite successful. These are students who don't have the money to go to UNO or UNL or Wayne State or Southeast Community College or Nebraska Indian Community College, but $2,000 will help. And I know from following them very closely that many of them have graduated. There's a Winnebago girl who is now an engineer in Southern California. What? She may be the only Winnebago engineer in the history of the Winnebago and is doing remarkably well. There's an Omaha girl, Rosalind Sansusi, who wanted to be a nurse. And she went to Clarkson Nursing College in Omaha, which is probably the best maybe nursing college in Nebraska. She got her degree. And she was inspired by Susan LaFleche, an Omaha Indian woman who became the first Native American, male or female, in the history of the United States to become a doctor from Walled Hill, Nebraska. And Rosalind kept seeing her photo on the wall, can't be what you can't see. And she would ask her teachers, who is that woman? They told her. She was so inspired, she decided she was going to become a nurse and go back to the reservation to help her Omaha people, which is exactly what she's doing. And that scholarship helped put her through nursing college. It doesn't get too much better than that, really. And so, yes, the scholarship was created to give as many Native students a chance to be on equal footing with more affluent students and give them a chance to earn a living and have a paycheck coming in because of the education that they got. That's the whole point.
That's a wonderful way, I think, to wrap up our time today on the front porch. We really appreciate hearing more about Chief Standing Bear and how you became involved in his story. And this story of what you are doing now with the scholarships is so inspiring as well. So thank you for all you're doing. We really appreciated your time.
Well, I really appreciate you giving me the opportunity and the platform to talk about something that's obviously very near and dear to my heart. I thank you for that opportunity. And we just want to keep spreading the word and uplifting as many people as we can by showcasing heroes and profiling people and using their stories to inspire this generation. That's the name of the game, and you are important players in that by helping to get out the word. So I really appreciate that.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. This was a great lesson for me, and he is a role model for me as well.
Yeah, well, that's great. That's wonderful. Keep up the good work. I just really thank you for looking out there and seeing this as an opportunity and selecting it and giving me the opportunity to answer your really, really excellent questions, by the way.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. You've done your homework, and I really appreciate that.
Nancy, oh my goodness. If I had had him for a history teacher, maybe I would have listened. He is so passionate and knowledgeable about his subject matter. And I appreciate the research so much that he did on this book and his passion for getting things right from a historical perspective.
You were getting a little teary-eyed near the end there, Lenny, weren't you?
I know. You noticed. I don't know if he noticed it all. I don't know if he noticed, but yes. Well, he's just so passionate. And here I go again. Oh, my goodness gracious. We had to start with the little girl.
Yes.
he is a good role model for all of us. You know, I thought of his name, Chief Standing Bear, and I thought his name suited him because he had a loud voice in some ways. His voice resonated loudly because of what he was saying and the platform that he had, and that he kept his story consistent and pure and honest with integrity. And I think that's a big takeaway for all of our generations, you know, and for all people.
Mm-hmm. I got a little teary thinking of the scholarship fund that Joe created and the way that he personally is trying to redress some of these wrongs that, you know, 150 years later, the Native American population is still suffering from the wrongs that were committed to them. If they still owned their homelands, they would be living different lives now. If they were still able to maintain their cultural practices, it would be a different story for them. But really, our dominant culture stripped everything away from them. And they're still, in so many ways, trying to recover from that injustice.
Well, yeah, that was hard to hear of the suicide rate and the poverty, which, of course, is outside of my lens being here in the Northeast. I guess I knew a little bit of that, but I didn't know it was to that extent in Nebraska, and my guess is other places too. Mm-hmm. So much work to be done, but a lot of wonderful things regarding Chief Standing Bear, and the spotlight that he has on him right now brings me hope. I do really hope that there is a movie on this.
Yes.
That would be really good. I support that.
Yeah, that would really introduce Chief Standing Bear to such a wide audience.
Yeah. Well, I'm really glad we chose that book, Nancy. I mean, you chose it, and I'm really glad that you did. It was a pleasure getting to know him and learning about him and the Ponca, and also in talking to the author.
Yeah.
Next month, we are going to review the novel, The Marriage Portrait, written by Maggie O'Farrell.
It's a completely different shift for us. This is a novel, and it takes place in Italy, Medici, Italy.
Oh, I want to go to Italy. That sounds good.
So Joe mentioned he spent a month in Italy. Here's our trip to Italy.
All right. Well, I'll download that on my Kindle next and start reading it.
Sounds good. Well, listeners, thanks for listening. Our website is frontporchbookclub.com.
Our episodes come out twice a month on the first and third Wednesday of every month.
See you next time, Lenny.
See you, Nance.
Ha 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 ha!